What can we learn about human nature and world history from a glass of water? Well, in his new book, Loon Shots, physicist and entrepreneur Safi Bacall reveals a new way of thinking about the mysteries of group behavior that challenges perhaps everything that we thought we knew about nurturing radical breakthroughs. Drawing on the science of phase transitions, Bacall shows why teams, companies, or any group with a mission will suddenly change from embracing wild new ideas to rigidly rejecting them, just as flowing water will suddenly change into brittle ice. Mountains of print have been written about culture. Loon Shots identifies the small shifts in structure that control this transition. Again, the name of the book is Loon Shots: How to Nurture the Crazy Ideas That Win Wars, Cure Diseases, and Transform Industries. Safi Bacall is a biotech entrepreneur and the author of the new book, and we welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks for having me.
What brought you to this idea of looking at the science that nurtures these ideas that may be out of the norm?
When I was a first-time CEO, it was about 20 years ago, I read everything I could find. I was like drinking from a fire hose about what it takes to build a better company, and I kept finding books about culture, culture, culture. And since I had a science background, I was really looking for, is there something beyond the sort of squishy psychology stuff? Is there a science to designing more innovative teams and companies? And that kind of led me to structure as opposed to culture.
So most of us have heard of the phrase moonshot. So what is a loon shot? How does it differ?
Well, loon shots are the small, crazy ideas that get neglected or dismissed for years or decades. They're champions written off as crazy. And everybody knows, as you say, what a moonshot is. And it is important to understand the difference, because missing loon shots, as many teams and companies have discovered, could be fatal. So here's an example of what I mean. When Kennedy announced to Congress in 1961 his goal of putting a man on a moon, he was widely applauded. 4 decades earlier, though, when Robert Goddard described the principles that might get us to the moon, jet propulsion and rocket flight, he'd been widely ridiculed. The New York Times, for example, wrote an editorial that Goddard didn't seem to understand the basic physics we teach children in high school, namely that Newton's laws and action-reaction make rocket flight impossible. Years later, after the successful Apollo 11 rocket launch to the moon, the paper issued a retraction saying the rockets did not, in fact, violate the laws of physics and, you know, quote, the Times regrets the error. So Kennedy's speech is the original moonshot, and Goddard's idea was a classic loonshot. A moonshot is a destination. Nurturing these loonshots is how we get there.
In 2011, President Obama invites you to be a part of his Council of Science Advisors on the future of national research. What was your task?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I really had very little experience in politics or science policy and didn't even know that much about history. But when I showed up, the chairman of our group said on the first day, your job is to create the next generation of the Vannevar Bush Report. How should we shape the next 50 years of national research? What should we do at the federal level? Unfortunately, I'd never heard of Vannevar Bush or his report, so I had to do some fast reading. And to some extent, that's the origin of this book, because I discovered that Vannevar Bush was the guy who, it was an engineer who created really a science for thinking about how to design more innovative teams and companies. And that science that he applied, understanding, let's say, the difference between the structure of organizations and the culture, helped turn the course of the war. And not only helped turn the course of World War II, it helped set the stage for the U.S. to lead the world in science and technology ever since.
So talk about that a little bit, because you point out in the book that Vannevar Bush didn't try to change military culture. He created a new structure. So how did that connect to what you had been thinking about?
Well, the idea is he got in there and he said, look, we are far behind Nazi Germany in the technologies that are going to make a difference for this war. And it's not that individually the military leaders resisted these technologies. they loved the idea of having new technologies, but there was something about collectively being in a group that made them reject many of those important technologies. And so he created a different structure within the federal government. He separated what we might call the artists, the creative scientists working on new products and new radical technologies, and the soldiers who were responsible for building, you know, millions of ships, guns, and putting them into battle. And so the underlying science of that is about what drives culture. Culture is what we see on the surface, the pattern of behavior. And underneath that is structure. Structure, the incentives, the design of the organization, how we build it, how we set it up, can drive those patterns of behavior. And Bush realized that we needed a different structure if we wanted to do radical innovation.
Your thought was about group structure, right? I mean, that it didn't have to be a lone crazy scientist in a lab. It could be that this group would ultimately be the one who would work together on the technology that would change this.
Right, and I think what's missing and what's so dangerous about what you read about a lot in the popular press about innovation is today you read about the focus on the heroic inventor and the genius idea, but just having an idea gets you from your goal to maybe the five-yard line. Getting from the 95 yards down the rest of the field is the vast majority of the work is a job of the soldiers. So the artists are the ones who kind of get you, have the original idea and have the creatives. And if you focus too much just on the idea and not on getting the ball down the rest of the field, you're going to drop the ball. And so what Bush did is he created one group to nurture those artists and take care of those ideas, and he kind of quarantined it from the soldiers who needed a very different model and a very different system for working to turn those ideas into useful products. So he quarantined those two, and he set up very different systems, and he focused on the transfer between the two, which is the failure point of most innovation, not in the supply of new ideas and not in picking out individual ideas.
To help us understand this, you make this comparison in the book, that the way groups change from embracing these new ideas, these wild ideas, to perhaps rejecting them, you compare this to the way water freezes in a glass of water.
Right. And there's one level, there's just sort of a metaphor or analogy, but what makes it interesting is that you could actually write down the mathematics behind that and think about what are the underlying incentives. And what you see is that the underlying incentives, if you create a structure that you pay people, you reward people based on rank. What's your hierarchy in the organization? What are you going to get? You're going to get politics. You're going to get people stabbing their neighbors and their colleagues down the hall in the back because they're going to want to get the next job up and they don't want their colleague to get it. And how did they stab them in the back? They shoot down their loonshot ideas, those crazy ideas. And so what you create, if you reward people on rank, is a very political culture that's very hostile to new ideas. On the other hand, if you reward people based on the success, on taking intelligent risks and coming around these crazy ideas and rescuing them when they stumble, and not at all based on rank, what are they going to do? They're going to nurture crazy ideas. You create a very innovative culture. So underlying those patterns of behavior, sort of political culture and innovative culture, which is very hard to change if you just look at the surface, is a structure, how you are motivating people. So that's kind of the underlying thesis, is that structure drives culture, and we spend so much time talking about the surface stuff of patterns of behavior and psychology, and let's get everybody in a room for 2 hours and watch a Kumbaya video about how we should all love our brother and, you know, help each other. But, you know, what's the effect of that? Nothing. People roll their eyes, they're frustrated, they're irritated. But let's figure out what really drives, what are they motivated by? I'm using financial stuff as an example. But non-financial, intangible rewards are equally important. So let's spend at least as much time talking about structure as we do about culture.
Okay, so bring us to the glass of water. You have the glass of water, what happens?
Right. So that is people don't think about this as much, but it's kind of an amazing thing. Imagine a glass of water, and I stick my finger in, and I can swirl it around. And that's true not only for water, but for any liquid. And that's always true, except as I gradually adjust the temperature, all of a sudden the behavior of those molecules completely changes. They become totally rigid. They freeze. Why? They're exactly the same molecules. So how do they know to completely change behavior? There's no CEO molecule with a bullhorn that's checking the temperature and saying, oh, it's 33, everybody be loosey-goosey and slosh around. Oh, it's 31 degrees, everybody line up rigidly. There's no CEO molecule, there's no videos about culture. They just do it. And so structure is the equivalent of what are those parameters, what are those equivalents of temperature that will cause behavior to change. Those are the underlying incentives that can change patterns of behavior. What are the forces acting on individuals inside groups?
I mean, one of those things, like, for example, an incentive that you write about in the book, and I mean, this obviously makes sense, that if you're part of the group, what you get paid is one of your incentives, right?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. If we look just at the tangible rewards, the how you are compensated, let's say everybody's paid on base salary. What you're really going to do is spend your energy trying to get promoted. And some of that might be around your work, but a lot of that might be about politicking your boss and lobbying your boss and shooting down your neighbors. On the other hand, if you get paid around the success of your project or the success of your team project, and your boss is not even involved in your decisions, there's an independent evaluator, are you going to spend time politicking your boss or shooting down your neighbors? No, there's no upside for you. So if we think about what are the underlying incentives for people, that's in some ways a much easier thing to address and adjust than trying to change psychology at the surface level.
So back to the glass of water for a moment, and so using that as our analogy, how do we extrapolate that to human beings, and you have that group together, and what is it then, at what point does the group change?
All right, that's a great question. So here's every phase transition in nature in 90 seconds, and we'll start with that glass of water.
Okay.
And phase transitions are all around us, and if you have time, I'll tell you, like, even when you're driving on a highway, you experience phase transitions all the time. But let's come back to the glass of water, which is asthma, because that's a really simple example. Every phase transition in nature is the result of a tug of war, two competing forces. In the case of water, one of those forces is called entropy, which wants to make molecules run around and be free. And at high temperature, entropy wins. And the other force is binding energy that wants to lock every molecule rigidly into place. 2.8 angstroms, not 2.7 or 2.9 angstroms, rigidly into place from its neighbor. So you have entropy, which wants to make them run around, and binding energy, which wants to lock them rigidly in place. And as you lower temperature, entropy gets weaker and weaker, and binding energy gets stronger and stronger, until at 32 Fahrenheit, boom, the two cross, and the system snaps, and water freezes. So every phase transition is like that. There are always two forces, and you adjust these parameters. At some critical point, they'll cross, and the system will freeze. So how does that apply to humans? I'll tell you about highways later, but you asked about humans. So let's talk about humans. Whenever you assemble people into a company or a team or any kind of group, profit, nonprofit, as long as there's a mission and a reward system tied to that mission, you create two forces. We can think of them loosely as equity and cash, but more specifically, stake and outcome and perks of rank. Stake and outcome and perks of rank. What do I mean by that? Well, just imagine you're pursuing something. Your stake and outcome is enormous, 100%. What you call yourself, if you call yourself a CEO or a VP or what you be, is of course irrelevant. That's sort of a joke. Now you add two people. Well, now your stake and outcome is 50%. And it doesn't really matter what you call each other. You're just all in it together, rolling up your sleeves. Now you grow to 10 people. Well, actually, now your stake and outcome has gone down a little bit. It's 10%. And now you kind of need somebody to be team captain, and maybe you need some sub-captains. So now there's some rank involved. So which matters more, being team captain or the 10%? Still pretty small, so probably the 10%. Now imagine you're 1,000 people. Well, your stake and outcome is 0.1%, less than 1%, very tiny. But there are all these levels now. And if you do some politicking and some complaining and some, like, stabbing your neighbor in the back, and some glorifying of your own stuff, you could get promoted. And then your salary goes up. So somewhere in between, the stake and outcome is very high when you're a small group, but it becomes very low when you're a large group. The perks of rank is irrelevant when you're small, but it grows to very large. So somewhere in between those two, it crosses. Just like the glass of water, as you change elements of organizational design, in this case we just talked about size, there are others, but as you change elements of structure, you adjust the balance between those two. And then the system will suddenly snap, and you go from embracing wild new ideas to rigidly rejecting them. Mm.
We're running out of time, but at what point do we can't guarantee success, right? But we can be careful to try to avoid the failure.
Right.
So at what point do we say, okay, we're all in, and this crazy idea just may be able to work?
Well, what we want to do is you mentioned failure. The important thing is to dive deep and understand the difference between true failures and what I call false failures. I'll give you an example by what I mean by that. When Mark Zuckerberg was going around a bunch of years ago trying to raise money for his new social network idea, most people wrote that off. Why? It seems kind of crazy in hindsight, but at the time, it was the 20th or 30th social network, and all of them up until then had failed. And especially there was one called Friendster where everybody was leaving. So one group, almost every investor turned it down. They said, look, these are bad business models, and users just hop from one social network to another like they change jeans every season. It's not a good business model. One investor group, Peter Thiel, said, really, is that a true fail? Is that really a failure of the business model that social networks can never make money? They're just like jeans. Let's take a look at Friendster. And he examined the data behind the user retention on Friendster, and he found that people were staying on an incredibly long time, and they were leaving to a new system because it was glitchy. The website didn't work very well. It was a software problem. So he wrote a check for $500,000, and he sold it for $1 billion 8 years later. And that's the difference between understanding a false fail and a true fail. It can make a very big return if you're an investor, but it make an equally big return if you're inside a company. You want to keep pursuing these ideas and probing underneath, not giving up prematurely.
The book is fascinating. It is entitled Loon Shots: How to Nurture the Crazy Ideas That Win Wars, Cure Diseases, and Transform Industries. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. Savi Bakal, I thank you very much for being with us. It's a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks very much, Joe. Glad to be on.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Loon Shots. It's published by St. Martin's Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.